This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Morris Dees, is a civil rights lawyer who helped virtually bankrupt two hate groups, the Klan and the White Aryan Resistance. In 1981, two members of the Klan lynched Michael Donald, a young black man, in Alabama. Instead of just going after these two men, Dees sued the Klan on behalf of the dead man's mother and won $7 million in damages. The decision set a precedent that a hate group could be held responsible for the violent actions of its members. Dees won a similar decision last year in a lawsuit against the White Aryan Resistance in Oregon. The court ordered this white supremacist group to pay $12.5 million in damages to the family of a black Ethiopian man who was murdered in Portland. Morris Dees is the head of the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. He co-founded this nonprofit legal and educational center in 1971. In his new memoir, A Season for Justice, Dees describes his life as a civil rights lawyer in the South and his strategy for putting hate groups out of business.
The individuals are usually pawns of the leaders of these groups. Historically, when a Klansman was caught for, say, killing Goodman Swirney and Cheney down in Mississippi, or Violet Uzo in Alabama, or for blowing up the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham to kill the four little girls, it was only some rank-and-file, low-level member that was caught. So, and when we had the case to represent Michael Donald, the killers of Michael Donald, the black man who was lynched in 1981 in Mobile, I decided that it was time to go around these local small-time people and go after the top leaders of the particular Klan group involved. They're the United Klans of America. And we showed that the United Klans of America even has a public front of being a nonviolent group. We traced a history of violence to carry out its goal, and that was the God-given supremacy of the white race as stated in their Constitution. And so we said, look, a corporation is responsible for the acts of its agents. Why shouldn't a Klan group be responsible for the acts of its members? And so that was the basis of it.
What had the legal obstacles in the past been that stood in the way of holding hate groups responsible for the actions of its members?
Well, there actually have been no legal obstacles at all. I think it's just nobody had the idea to do it. They always went for the person with the smoking gun or the can of gasoline at the black church. Some of the obstacles that have been raised by, I think, misinformed people, say like in the ACLU, is that wait a minute, you can't go out to a group because you're going to violate their freedom of speech. And in all the cases that I've done, whether it's the most recent one against the White Aryan Resistance and its leader Tom Metzger for the acts of skinheads up in Portland for killing a black man, they always scream First Amendment. But when you get down to the bare facts, and if you have the right kind of investigation, which we detail in the book that I've just written, you'll see that in the case of the White Aryan Resistance, they actually sent a corporate vice president of the White Aryan Resistance to Portland, Oregon, for the purpose of organizing skinheads. And we were able to uncover documents that showed that they gave him material to pass out that encouraged bashing blacks over the heads with baseball bats. We had a piece of video footage that we had where Tom Metzger, the head of the group, encouraged skinheads to commit violence against minorities. And we had also some undercover photographs of Tom Metzger in the desert in Arizona training skinheads to shoot AK-47 Chinese assault rifles. So with that kind of evidence, the ACLU backs off because they see that this is not like you're trying to say that an anti-abortion group should be held liable if somebody goes and burns an abortion clinic. And that's just because some strong rhetoric by the anti-abortion group. It's quite different. Here we're talking about actual encouragement to commit violent acts, not simply just rhetoric.
Was it conspiracy charges you were using?
Yes, it was. That was one of the three claims that we made in both the case in Mobile, where we got a $7 million verdict against the United Klans of America, and the case recently in Oregon, where we got a judgment of $12 million against war, White Aryan Resistance. We claimed that they conspired to injure minorities because of the goals of the organization, and was carried out through their lower-level members.
Now, is the kind of prosecution that you've been doing dependent on having informants within the organization?
Not so much informants, because usually the lynching takes place, or the death, or the blowing up of a synagogue, or whatever, and then you get into the investigation of it. And we've been successful in getting high-level members of these organizations. For example, in war, we got Dave Mazzella, the National Vice President of Recruitment, to turn against his former leaders. A young man who meant well. He just a young man who had been misguided and wanted something more out of life than the hate he'd been taught. I talked to him. I met with him, and he decided that he was going to tell what Tom Metzger had told him to do, and had what he sent him to Oregon to do, and what he did when he got to Oregon. This is, I think, essential to convince a jury that we aren't just out trying to go after these groups because of unpopular beliefs. In the case against the United Klans of America, for example, or the one up in North Carolina against the White Patriot Party, where they'd stolen some $50,000 worth of military supplies, hand grenades, C4 plastics, to supply to a neo-Nazi group called the White Patriot Party, we was able to get the actual person who bought and stole quite a few of this stuff from Fort Bragg and who actually got active duty United States military personnel to teach these people in the woods of North Carolina to come forward and testify.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Morris Dees. He is the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center and of Klan Watch. And there's a new memoir that's just been published called A Season for Justice, The Life and Times of Civil Rights Lawyer Morris Dees. In 1988, you won a decision against the Ku Klux Klan, and the jury found them responsible for $7 million in damage. That suit was said to have bankrupted the United Klans of America. But the Klan is still in business.
This particular Klan group, the United Klans of America, was the largest, most violent Klan group this country's had in, you know, many, 50 years. That Klan group was bankrupted. Its national headquarters was sold and the property given to the mother of Michael Donald, a black woman, Ms. Beulah May Donald. There are other splinter Klan groups, usually existing even no more than a post office box and in the minds of five or six people. Five Klansmen will put on sheets, march down the street, and it looks like you have a Klan organization. You really don't. There is no real effective Klan organization in the country today. The United Klans was the most dangerous, violent group this country's had in 50 years, responsible for the deaths of probably 50 or 75 black people and whites during the Civil Rights Movement. That's the group that we went after and targeted and bankrupted.
And what's the difference between the United Klans of America and the Ku Klux Klan?
Well, Ku Klux Klan is just a term that represents Klan that was a group of white supremacists organized back right after the Civil War. There's groups called the Invisible Empire, Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. That's a group that we've gotten $1 million verdict against recently and put them out of business. There's a group called the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the White Knights of the Camellia Ku Klux Klan. And they've got about 50 or 75 sub-names. The United Klans of America, though, was a coalition of a number of Klan groups that came together during the Civil Rights Movement days and wrecked and wreaked havoc across the Southeast in bombings, church bombings, the things you saw in Mississippi burning.
Now, last year, you won a $12 million lawsuit against the white Aryan resistance. What effect is that verdict having on their ability to carry on? Have they been bankrupted?
The property where the national headquarters is and on the property belonging to Tom Metzger, the owner of White Aryan Resistance, which, by the way, is a for-profit organization, and his followers were surprised to find that revelation we made in court. We are in the process of selling that property to satisfy this judgment and also have seized all of his equipment and personal property. You can't stop Tom Metzger from making talks or being on a Donahue show, which he was recently. But what we have stopped is his ability to pay for organizers to go out, organize skinheads, which was the territory of the white supremacy market he staked out. You can stop that because you don't have any money. All the money coming to his post office box where people are sending in contributions, dues, et cetera, has been seized by a court, and our collectors go down, get the money out of the box, and give him the mail. So I think that effectively that organization will be eliminated. And in the process, we're collecting money for the 9-year-old son of Melagata Sarah, who was beaten to death. This child has no means of support, and his total support is going to come from the money that we get.
What kinds of precedents do you think that these suits against hate groups have set?
Well, I think they set a powerful precedent. First of all, from a legal standpoint, the theories we use can be used against any group that uses violence to carry out its means. when it goes over the line of First Amendment protected speech. Another precedent it sets, or at least a message it sends out, is to the rank and file members of these organizations. They see that it may cost them money. They may get hit in the pocketbook, and sometimes that's even more effective than putting them in jail.
Which are the hate groups now that you think really count, the ones that actually have some power left?
Well, quite frankly, none has any power as the Order or the Aryan Nations or the War or the Klan groups. I think they've all been thrown in disarray by our lawsuits and by the very effective action of the Justice Department in prosecutions. That's not to say that you don't have organized white supremacists and they're not carrying out their message, but as far as an effective group, they're gone. And a lot of it's happened, too, because there's been a change in attitude in the country. Today, unfortunately, though, there's a rising tide of racial violence in America, not so much sponsored by hate groups, but the kind of thing you saw in Bensonhurst, New York, where whites attacked black from coming into their neighborhood. In 1990, there were more hate crime murders in America than there was in 1964. In 1964, there was 18, and that was the highest number in any year in the civil rights movement time frame. And these, in 1964, all of those murders took place in the Deep South. In 1990, those 22 murders took place all over the United States, only two in the Deep South. So we have a totally different kind of problem. We have a backlash in this country today on race matters. We have a deeply divided racial gap between whites and blacks. We have demagogues on both sides. We have a president of the United States who uses a Willie Horton commercial showing a black man to create fear, and I think, in the minds of white voters. And then you have Jesse Jackson going to New York in the election before, calling New York Hymie Town. And you have people like Tawana Brawley's handlers who said, well, it doesn't matter that Tawana Brawley was really not raped. Blacks have been raped before. So what? You know what? But you can't build a movement on lies and truths and demagoguery. The message that Dr. King so poignantly got across in his movement was one of love and love and of understanding and of brotherhood and sisterhood. And that's what we've got to deal with today.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Morris Dees, and he's co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center and of the group Klan Watch. And he has a new memoir called A Season for Justice. This is Fresh Air. Civil rights lawyer Morris Dees is my guest. You were just making the point that hate groups aren't as powerful as they were, but there sure is a lot of hatred and hate crimes in the United States. It's just that it's more on an individual basis as opposed to an organized basis. So what kind of work do you see your group doing in the near future?
Well, when I tried the case of Michael Donald, his mother inspired me through something she did in the courtroom to launch a national education program. She was sitting there faced with the Klansman that lynched her son. And I tell this story better, I guess, in the book, and I can do it personally because I get a little emotional trying to tell it orally. And as the Klansman stood up, overcome with emotion himself, and begged her forgiveness for the lynching of her son in that little courtroom in Mobile, she looked at him and she said, "Son, I've already forgiven you." And I sat there and watched her. And Tommy, that wasn't a dry eye in the jury, on the bench, at the council table. And I sat there watching this black woman who lost the most precious thing in her life look at this man in the face, this white man who killed her son, and say that. And that was, to me, a higher justice than that court could ever render. It's a kind of love that we talk so much about but know so little of. And I tried to capture the spirit of that in my book, and I tried to point out how we needed to move forward with an educational program. I think we're moving from the classroom to the classroom from the courtroom, because I think that you can just do so much getting judgments against these people. You've got to change the hearts and minds of both black and white Americans.
You at one time learned that you were on a hit list from one of the hate groups, along with Alan Berg, who was actually murdered, and Norman Lear. In what ways have you been harassed and threatened because of your attacks against the hate groups?
Well, in 1983, the Southern Poverty Law Center was burned to the ground by a group of Klansmen. We caught the one that did it. He was on the Imperial Council of a group called the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. He got 15-year prison sentence for it. That was a direct result of us representing the Vietnamese fishermen in Galveston Bay against the Klan trying to run them out and burn their boats, etc. after that, I've had a number of death threats. People have come on my property, and one of them stayed out there, was paid money to try to kill me. And fortunately, I've had a tremendous amount of help from the FBI. They have a team of people that work very closely with us and provide us a lot of information. We have our local security.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Morris Dees, who is the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center and of Klan Watch. He has a new memoir called A Season for Justice, The Life and Times of Civil Rights Lawyer Morris Dees. You know, you've pioneered a lot in the way of civil rights litigation. You've also done a lot of pioneering in the work of direct mail for fundraising. Before you became a civil rights lawyer, you were a businessman, and you started a very successful business, which I think helped you become a millionaire. And you were basically using direct mail to sell books. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you learned about direct mail in business that you were able to apply to fundraising for the purposes of civil rights litigation?
Well,
and I should say that you started doing this before direct mail became really known as a technique of Tom Vigory and the right.
Right. Well, Richard Vigory and I...
Richard Vigory, right. Yeah.
Yeah, Richard Vigory is, in fact, is a friend of mine. And I guess the thing that I used when I was McGovern's National Finance Director in 1972, we got 700,000 people to contribute $24 million to his campaign because he had no other way to raise his money to get the Democratic nomination then. It was the same things I used when I started my book club and direct mail book club and other things, and that is we weren't ashamed to sell. We presented McGovern in all of the details necessary for people to make a decision to sit down and write a check, not the simple one-page letter, but the more detailed explanation, because I would like to bring the reader of this mail that we send out as close to the counsel table as I'm sitting and put them in the chair next to me so they can understand and feel the pain and hurt of Mrs. Donnelly as she sits and has to listen to this. And the only way to do that sometimes is to maybe take a piece of transcript of her testimony and reproduce that and send it out to our supporters so they can see. And when our building was burned in 1983, I mean, it hurt me. I mean, I sat on the curb outside of my building and cried that this was happening to me. And in order for our donors to know what we felt, we had pictures taken of this immediately and got it out to all of our donors. We didn't ask a penny in return. I just wanted them to feel what I felt and what our people felt, that what we was going through. This technique, as you want to call it, to me is just really good. You might call it sales, selling, or advertising, or whatever it might be. I don't in any way apologize for this. In fact, groups like the ACLU and Sierra Club and Cousteau Society, Greenpeace, Planned Parenthood, NARAL, Now, I've helped all of those groups over the years to go from the time when they would send their donors one contribution request a year and apologize for that. And I've sat down with the board of Planned Parenthood and said, look, your contributors want to fight Jesse Helms, who's trying to end the right to abortion. You've got to write these people every 3 or 4 weeks because that's how much that's why your money needs are great. You can't just write them once a year with an apologetic, you don't want to really give, do you?
Do you think there's any fundamental differences between the way the left and the right use direct mail?
I don't know. I don't raise money for the left or the right. And so I really don't know. There are extremists on both sides that, you know, that try to raise money by getting, by being shrill, or Richard Vigory might raise money by trying to make it seem like your life will end if you don't get Teddy Kennedy out of there and you don't, if you don't abolish people trying to stop gun control, or if you don't fight for against abortion, et cetera. And on the left, we find people that really, quite frankly, almost relish in the success of the Klan when they have a march because it focuses the issue. Some of these radical anti-Klan groups in the country are actually the Klan's best friend, because when the Klan goes out in the street, these people, they don't really feel the Klan has a First Amendment right to march, which I do. They'll go out in the street and break through police lines, and so you get more of them arrested than the Klan. Klan looks good by comparison to these kind of people. Their fundraising, though, I've seen, has not been very successful. I guess we probably reach a more middle-of-the-road group. We published an intelligence report that goes to 5,000 law enforcement agencies, worked very closely with the FBI, the Justice Department, and it brought them around to seeing the danger that's happening and brought them around to bringing lawsuits. They may surprise a lot of people, but the Reagan-Bush Justice Department filed more lawsuits against the Klan, put more Klansmen in jail than all prior Justice Departments put together.
Because you have successfully prosecuted hate groups, you've been the target of hate groups yourself. One of the ways that hate groups try to intimidate people like you probably is to threaten your family as well as yourself. Has that ever happened? And I'm wondering how you've wrestled with that. I mean, sometimes a lot of people who will feel perfectly fine being the target themselves will want to do everything in their power to protect their families. I'm sure you've had to wrestle with this. How do you deal with it?
My 14-year-old daughter was in our home when the Klan came on the property, or some white supremacists, and the guards put us in a little room, and it was quite a moving thing to see her sit there and tremble in fear. But she overcame it and looked at in that room that night and said to me, you know, after we'd been there a while, that, Dad, you know, she said, I'm reading Anne Frank now in school, and she said, you know, this is nothing compared to what those children went through in Germany. And it really got to me. And that night after we went to bed, after the FBI left, she had put the Christmas tree angel over the top of my bed. And my family has really supported me. They hadn't run from this fight. And, you know, and I think that they'd probably would not want me to quit just simply because there's some danger.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry, for having me.
My guest has been Morris Dees, the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he has a new memoir called A Season for Justice, The Life and Times of Civil Rights Lawyer Morris Dees. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.